You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game, because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker. And a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Within the studio, only one other, Neil Payne, sports writer 538. Just the two of us.
All you need.
I believe Kate Fagan is somewhere in Russia, is what the the news told me.
Hope she hasn't been captured by the Kremlin.
You don't know. We might have some really good listeners inside the Kremlin. I think Putin is into hot takes.
He could be.
He's a hot take machine.
Yeah.
Neil, on today's show, the Super Bowl is set, and we're still going to talk about the Patriots. Does the Patriots loss tell us anything about the Belichick-Brady era? And I guess if we have time, we can talk about the Panthers and Broncos, too. And then we'll talk about David Blatt and what went wrong in Cleveland. How did a guy with an 83-40 career record in the NBA get fired? And did he deserve it? And finally, Carl Bialik, 538's very own Carl Bialik, will join us to discuss the match-fixing scandal in tennis. I guess it's not a scandal yet. Story in tennis? When does something go from story to scandal? Nothing's been confirmed.
Right. I mean, it's almost like this nebulous sort of, there's evidence of it, but has it blown into a full-blown scandal? I don't know. It's like when people use math to discover planets, but we can't actually see planets.
It's true. I guess my point is that scandal implies that someone has been, if not proven guilty, at least like called to the mat somehow, right? They've like been hauled away to the court. I don't think this qualifies.
Well, the players were identified, but yeah, we can talk
about
it. But
only not, we'll talk with Carl.
Indirectly identified.
Where was I? Yes, is data really all we need to identify players who are losing on purpose is one of the other things we'll talk about with Carl Bialik for that segment. Neil, you ready to talk NFL?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, listeners, I promise that we're going to talk about the Panthers and Broncos Super Bowl.
Yeah, I liked at the top of the show you're like, we're going to talk about the Patriots and Tom Brady, and maybe if we have time we'll talk about those two teams who actually won.
Great accomplishments, but the Patriots... There's still some things we need to break down about the Patriots.
It's true.
So that game between the Broncos and Patriots sort of had it all to me. There was Brady and Manning. There was an offensive-defensive clash. And there was Gronk getting leg massages on the sideline. The Broncos won 20-18, but only after the Patriots didn't complete a two-point conversion in the final minute of the game. Immediately after the game ended, Steven Gostkowski heaped blame on himself for missing an extra point in the first quarter. Let's listen to Mr. Gostkowski.
I should have made it. You know, I've made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those. And just sometimes timing is everything, and I never would have thought missing a kick in the first quarter would be the difference in the game. You know, I came up short today. I let a lot of people down, a lot of guys on the team, a lot of fans. You know, all I can do now is stand up here and take it all on me. You know, I feel like I lost the game for the team.
Can one missed extra point in the first quarter lose a game?
No, of course it can't.
So you're saying Steven Gostkowski can start sleeping again?
Yes.
Those lashes he's been giving himself are for no reason.
Yeah.
He can rejoin the world of the living.
Yeah. You know, obviously, and you knew that it was going to happen when the fates sort of wound that game down the path of, oh gosh, they have to go for two here to tie it. If only Gostkowski had made the extra point, then, you know, they wouldn't be in this position. With that hindsight, yeah, it's like super tempting. You knew that people were going to be talking about it when that happened. But if you look at like the actual at the time change in win probability, which is the odds of winning the game based on the current, you know, situation, the score, who the teams that are playing are, you know, the time left in the game. The change was maybe like one percentage point from the moment of them scoring the touchdown and then the Broncos getting the ball back. Was the Broncos' odds of winning went from 45.5% after the touchdown to 46.4% after Gostkowski kicked the touchback on the very next play. So we're not talking about we're talking about minuscule changes.
That's the equivalent of like a third down or fourth down conversion that wasn't completed be well third down conversion not completed is that equivalent to what we're talking about here? Is
oh,
that
yeah.
would that be worth a 1 point percentage point win probabilities shift?
Yeah, for instance, on the very next play when CJ Anderson ran when Peyton Manning completed a pass to CJ Anderson for 3 yards. It on second down and 7, it dropped Denver's chances of winning by 1 point of win probability.
So CJ Anderson should have blamed himself if the Broncos had lost that game.
If they had lost the game, he could have pointed to that and blamed himself. I mean, that's the absurdity of sort of using the benefit of hindsight to punish or parcel out blame to players, because in the moment, there were so many more things that could have happened in that game. There, it was a little bit less than 2 minutes left in the first quarter when he missed that extra point. So you still have more than 45 minutes left in the game in which a bunch of things can happen. From that perspective, at that moment, you don't know what could happen. So that's the benefit of something like win probability is that it sort of just puts you in the snapshot of the moment and only allows you to have the information that you are privy to in that moment when assessing whether a play, you know, is good or bad, because it's not fair to bring in all of the subsequent things that happened over the course of that game and then use that against Gostkowski. They could have won, you know, easily from that point on, or they could have lost in a landslide and we wouldn't be talking about it. It's just because of all these other plays that other people made that blew his extra point miss out of proportion.
And we should know that Gostkowski is one of the best kickers in the league.
And that
this
was
season.
His first miss of the entire season. So you can make the case based
for
on
extra points.
His right on extra points based on his performance, especially since extra points were missed somewhat more this season than they were in the past. They changed the distance, that he more than made up for that one percentage point of win probability over the course of the season by being that much better than any other kicker at making extra points. So there's kind of this cruel irony to it that he would miss the extra point that he hadn't missed all season, and then it came back to haunt, when we look retrospectively, to haunt the Patriots. But at the same time, by any objective measure, he didn't cost them the game, and he was, you know, very valuable kicker this season.
So, and one of those other things that may have, well, not cost the Patriots the game, but affected the outcome of the game was Tom Brady just feeling pressured left and right and not being the efficient quarterback that we're used to seeing. Neil, for a site on 538 this week, about Tom Brady's history when getting a really good pressure from the defensive line, you noted that Brady has always had a problem with this, that when there are people in his face, maybe not blitzing, but just pressuring the quarterback, forcing his speed to hurry up, that he doesn't do as well as other quarterbacks.
Yeah, since ESPN Stats and Info Group began tracking pressure reliably around the 2009 season, Brady had one of the biggest drop-offs in performance between when he's unpressured and when he is pressured of any quarterback in football. And that's sort of something that we intuitively know. Like anyone who watched that first Giants Super Bowl, for instance, saw that when you're able to get pressure on Brady, and the salient thing also is they weren't blitzing. They weren't blitzing on Sunday. The Broncos were able to generate a lot of pressure. 16 of the 19 times that they got to Brady and forced pressure, they did it without sending an extra rusher. And of course, you know, any quarterback crumbles under those circumstances because it's a numbers game. You don't have to sacrifice coverage to get the pressure when you're able to overwhelm the offensive line, and that's exactly what Denver's front four did.
Can I just pause here and tell you a pet peeve of mine when I watch football broadcasts, Neil?
Sure, please really do. I mean, all of us have many pet peeves, I feel like, when we watch football broadcasts.
So during the game, speaking of pressure on the quarterback, they had that stat box that you often see about the number of times that Brady had been hurried, knocked down, and maybe sacked, I think might have been the third one.
Hit,
right?
Maybe?
Maybe hit, yeah, exactly.
The under pressure box.
Here's the problem, Neil.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, they don't make it clear what's a subset of one another.
Mm-hmm.
For example,
mm-hmm.
every time that it could be that you're hurried and you get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it does not tell me whether or not one stat is encompassing another. And I find that to be a real dereliction of duty on the
part of the broadcasters. Oh, I completely agree, and I have that same thought. every time that they show that up. Obviously, every sack is a subset of hits because you have to get hit unless you're Brett Favre gifting Michael Strahan records, but we'll put that aside. But yeah, like hurried. Seems like, you know, you got the throw off, I think, is the definition of that.
Maybe scrambled a bit.
But yeah, it was pressure, but it's not. It's definitely
also,
not clear.
Also, if you're a scrambling quarterback, does that mean you're hurried more often?
That's true. And yeah, one of the things that while I was looking at the pressure stats is that it seems like quarterbacks like Russell Wilson, Colin Kaepernick, guys who move around in the pocket, they do experience more of what, at least by ESPN stats and info definition, would be considered pressure. So some of this is just the scheme that you play in and the characteristics of you as a quarterback. Of course, Brady is kind of the opposite of that, where, you know, he's very cool and collected and usually, you know, is very decisive with the ball. And we saw a few times in the game on Sunday where once he, you know, the pocket started breaking down, he went through his progressions, no one was open. He looked kind of like a peewee player out there sometimes, like he was, you know, confused about where to put the ball. And again, I go back to some of the Giants Super Bowls where you saw that when he is flustered, you know, you can get to him and you can force him to have a bad game when you take away that comfort level in the pocket and the progressions that he's able to make.
Okay, so we'll talk about the Broncos next week.
Peyton.
We are certainly going to talk about Peyton. I have lots of
the
questions.
The sheriff,
about
as
Peyton.
Cam Newton called him.
That's right. Does this tell us anything about the Brady Belichick era, this loss? I mean, they're both getting older. I'm not sure Belichick, the age is going to affect his play necessarily, but Brady had a very good season, much better than Manning when you look at what age did to Manning. I mean, is this just a blip? And like, how Neil, when you're looking at this from an empirical standpoint, do you try and make sense of whether or not this was indicative of anything larger about Brady or about the dynasty that we've seen?
No, I mean, I don't know that it necessarily means anything or that you can glean anything about, like, maybe Brady getting older, because he did have such a fantastic year, especially for a quarterback of his age. I do think it's interesting that, you know, you expect New England to lose some of these games. They've won so many conference championship games that maybe on the ledger over the course of Brady's entire career, they're still ahead of what you would expect from, like, the Vegas odds going into the game. Or, you know, we have these ELO ratings, which are power ratings of each team. But I did some research a couple of years ago where I was looking into this thing that our friend Chase Stewart, who runs footballperspective.com, he had written a piece about the Manning Index. And it was early in Manning's career when he was sort of losing these playoff games at home, maybe divisional round games even. Manning had a huge gap between how many playoff games he was expected to win based on these pregame odds and how many he actually won. And that's the Manning Index, is the differential between your expected wins and your actual wins. And of course, Brady was at the other end of the spectrum. He had won, I mean, at one point he was, what, like 11-0 in his career, 10-0 in his career in playoff games, because they, you know, won so many Super Bowls in a row to start his career. And he was the leader in the Manning Index, the anti-Manning. But if you take, like, this point in Brady's career halfway through and you throw out everything before that, you find that his Manning Index number is actually sort of below average. He's won fewer games or maybe won just as many games as would be expected, but he's not this outlier performer. Mm-hmm. And you find this for a lot of quarterbacks. Brett Favre, for instance, where if you look at the back end of their career, they disappoint relative to expectations in this index. And if you look at the beginning of their career, they outperform the index. And I don't know if it's just a matter of Vegas sort of putting their faith in quarterbacks that have a certain stature and maybe it's unfounded, or if these guys truly are like kind of it's an aging effect where they're capable of getting a team to a point where they have a certain rating and they have home field in the playoffs, but then they can't get them through that game as consistently. I don't know. But it's interesting to kind of look at the arcs of careers, and Brady is a fascinating one because, you know, he has had such success, and then he went through a period where he was losing Super Bowls, and then he went back and won again. So I don't know that this one game means a lot in that context, but it's still interesting.
Okay, so let's leave it there for now. We know, because the NFL takes 2 weeks off, we're forced to vamp a little bit. We got to kill some time. We can't talk about the Panthers and the Broncos quite yet. We got a whole other week of football that we got to, or football time we got to fill next week on Hot Takedown.
And who doesn't want to talk more about Tom Brady?
Well, yeah, that too. All right, so stay tuned, listeners, for next week's episode with Kate Fagan, presumably.
If she's safe
for
from
Super
Russia.
Super Bowl breakdown. We're going to send Neil off to the Super Bowl. Your first Super Bowl, Neil, that you're going to?
Yeah.
All right, excellent. All right, let's move on to the NBA. It wasn't so long ago that we were noting how lucky a guy David Blatt was, rookie head coach, best player in the world. What could go wrong? Well, you could lose your job after a season and a half. Blatt is out of a job after he was fired from the Cleveland Cavaliers last week, reportedly after long simmering differences with LeBron James finally became too much for the management to handle. Because the Cavs were so good, first place in the Eastern Conference, kind of good, that left a lot of pundits trying to divine what went wrong. Here's Brian Windhorst doing his best to both say what went wrong and why he knew it was always going to go wrong.
At the end of the day, there was just not a level of respect between LeBron and David Blatt. And because LeBron didn't have the absolute respect for him, his teammates didn't either. To be dead honest about this, the Cavs probably should have released David Blatt the day after LeBron James signed. Having David Blatt coach this team compared to the team he was actually hired to coach just 3 weeks earlier, it's like ordering a vegan meal and then being delivered a filet mignon.
It's just like that, Neil. So
if you're not a vegan, that sounds fantastic.
So what?
to order a vegan meal and then get a filet mignon instead.
Well, yeah, I didn't quite understand the analogy because... Well,
is he saying Blatt is a vegan, though?
I think his point is that the steak is wasted on Blatt.
Okay.
Because
he's a vegan.
He was a vegan.
The basketball vegan.
Because nothing says veganism like like coaching some young upstarts like Andrew Wiggins. Andrew Wiggins really reminds me of not a raw carrot, maybe like a julienne carrot marinated in like a harissa soy sauce glaze.
I think there's some kale involved.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I think really Kale was Anthony Bennett.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know,
throwing shade on Kale,
looked like
Chad.
The thing that was best for you, but in retrospect, probably wasn't something that was as nutritious as it seemed.
Can we all just agree quinoa is somehow involved?
Yeah, that's
is that Kyrie Irving?
Yeah.
Quinoa Irving.
All right, so back to basketball. all right, so let's start with the basics here. Was there any evidence that Blatt A was a bad coach, or B, even if he was a good coach, that the lack of respect, as Windhorst said, was somehow affecting the team's performance and play?
Well, so I don't think there was a lot of evidence that he was a particularly good coach. Like last year, the Cavs had an enormous amount of talent, and this is something that we've seen in the past, where, for instance, when LeBron and Chris Bosh joined the Heat back in 2010, that they took some time to coalesce. So maybe we'll cut them a little bit of slack. But that team won only 53 games. They did go to the finals. They lost in the finals.
Largely because the Dykon Radish, Matthew Dellavedova sort of withered, shall we say, wilted, rather,
yeah,
in the final few
games. And I don't know what our metaphor for Kevin Love and his absence is. But, yeah, I mean, that team, it was such an interesting arc of the season that they had. But ultimately, I would say 53 wins is probably less than they mm-hmm. should have given the talent that they had a year ago. And then this year, if you look at like the preseason, we have ELO ratings for basketball also. We would have said that the Cavs would win about 63 games this season. And they were on pace at the time of Blatt's firing to win 60 games. So, again, like, it's hard to find fault with a 60-win performance from a team, but I would say that you could probably call his performance getting what you would have expected out of it. So it's not good or great, but it's also not horrendous. And speaking of the difference between expectations and actuality, Nate Silver, who is our editor-in-chief, he did a story last year about what it takes for a coach to get fired. And typically it's underperforming relative to expectations. So if you're expected to win 63 games and you only win 60, there's only a 26% chance that you're going to get fired. So by that standpoint, you could say that even though he disappointed a little bit, it was pretty unlikely that he'd get fired.
Let me make a totally unsubstantiated point, as mm-hmm. as I want. Mm-hmm. Expectations are relative to talent on the team, mm-hmm. of course, but they're also relative to the league around you. We have two teams in the league that are clearly well-coached, well-balanced, running a complex and advanced system, both offensively and defensively. And I wonder if the Warriors and Spurs had something to do with this, right? Like if you're a 60-win team in the Eastern Conference, the same Cavs team, where other teams in the league are not transcendently good. Does that have – I mean, it would be hard to see the numbers, but am I way off base? Do you think about that being a part of this too?
I mean, I don't know. Like, maybe you look around and you see these other teams that you feel like you should be contending with for that 72-10 Chicago Bulls record or something like that.
But that's a once-in-a-generation.
And when you don't see that – right, yeah. You know, if that is your bar that you're wanting to be among that group, the Spurs and the Warriors this year, the Spurs' performance last night notwithstanding, are all-time historically great teams, and the Warriors have been so for 2 years now, going on two seasons at least. So, I mean, the Cavs, if you look at their performance at the time of blast firing, they're fifth in offensive efficiency, fourth in defensive efficiency. They, you know, were running a slow-paced offense, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But, I mean, other characteristics of their team don't suggest that they had some kind of deficient system. They were making shots from the floor. They weren't turning the ball over too much. They were playing solid defense. I just, you know, if you're going to use that argument, I mean, they were moving the ball. They were 13th in the percentage of field goals that are assisted. So there's a lot of like indicators in there that this wasn't an unhealthy system necessarily. And so I don't think that that is really an argument that could be made unless you're making that comparison to these historically all-time great teams.
I'm pro Blatt in this fracas.
I feel like I kind of am too.
I understand the role that morale can play within a workplace, that, you know, you want people to be feeling good, especially when they're working as a team every night, as the Cavs were. And so I don't discount the non-numbers element of that, right? And we don't know what higher morale might mean for team performance when it comes to the Cavs. But it's difficult for me to think that the coach was really the rot at the center of what
or
sounds like
a was there system. A rot? I mean, yeah. You know, it's chemistry. There's the
anonymous sources suggest yes.
Oh, sure, of course. And there were a lot of competing spin pieces. You know, one from LeBron's camp about how Blatt was incompetent. One from, you know, the perspective of the Cavs, I guess, that, you know, there was the this rift where Blatt, you know, kept saying, "Don't you know how many championships I've won in Europe and overseas?" And Kyrie Irving being like, "You're an NBA virgin after winning your first game." Yeah. So, yeah, that's got a great on you know, locker room tensions and create that.
Okay, let's talk about what comes next for the Cavs now that Tyronn Lue is the head coach. After Lue's first game what does the coach get a certain chair? Standing on the sidelines, I guess, right? No assistant coach stands.
You get to stand and crouch occasionally.
Yeah, right, yeah. In the stand-crouch position on the sidelines, Lue said this about the team's conditioning.
The vision that I have for this team, I think we got to play faster. I think we got to utilize Kyrie and LeBron's one-on-one ability in transition, open the floor more, running more drags, and getting their weak side big out. And we just haven't been accustomed to playing that way. So, you know, something new. So I got to do a better job of getting us in some better shape.
Better shape, faster. Everyone wants to play fast. This is a separate hot takedown, but at what point does a slow team get the market advantage on the fast teams? We can deal with that later.
Sure.
Meanwhile, for right now, Neil, I'm a little all over the place today. Right now, Neil, tell me, do the Cavs really play as slowly as Lue is making them out to play?
Yeah, I mean, they rank 28th in pace, or at least they did at the time of Blatt's firing, and that's the number of possessions per 48 minutes. So they're definitely one of the slower teams in the league. And it's not a bad idea to talk about pushing the pace. But at the same time, if you look at the characteristics of this team, and I kind of broke it down statistically where I looked at, you know, relative to the league, the team's average height, weight, age, and also some of these athleticism characteristics of them, like blocks per minute and steals per minute and offensive rebounds. If you look at those for the Cavs, they are sort of almost predestined to be a slow team. Given the building blocks, the physical characteristics of the team, there was only a 31% chance that a team constructed like this would be able to be league average in pace. Hmm. There's only a 10% chance that they'd be able to rank in the top five. In other words, teams that look like this. This Cavs team, they're old, they're big, they're heavy, and they're rate pretty low in these athletic categories, even though we think about LeBron.
They're just not in good enough shape, Neil. That's the problem.
I mean, maybe they're not in good enough shape, and maybe that is contributing to it, but there's things that are pretty big roadblocks to them perhaps being in the type of shape that Tyronn Lue is.
And yet they're still playing
they
a slower pace than even we expected based on all that.
That's true, yes. So they had the seventh biggest shortfall between the actual pace and the pace that we would expect based on their physical characteristics. But at the same time, that expected pace was one of the slowest paces in the league as it is. So I think it's kind of unreasonable to expect them to be almost like a run-and-gun warrior-style team.
And wouldn't that even make them play worse, right?
This is they played so well given the personnel that they have and the system that they've been playing, which has been one of the slowest teams over the last 2 years. So in a certain sense, why mess with success? And that kind of goes to the whole argument of the Blatt firing, in a nutshell, is they've been successful this year. They've quasi lived up to expectations. The risk of making a change like this, almost from my perspective, just subjectively, seems like it outweighs the reward.
I think the Cavs have a Warriors complex, which is you see another team with a transcendent talent, building a team around that talent that revolves around him, but also accentuates various things and can perform with him off the court. And there is real folly in trying to emulate that with your own team if you don't have the talent that could do it. And we talked many times on the show about Stephen Curry and whether or not it's silly to even try to build an offense like the Warriors, because unless you have a player as good at being Curry as Curry is at being Curry,
right,
that you can't run that kind of fast three-point oriented offense.
Yeah, and this is a veteran team. They're not going to be able to run up and down the floor as fast. So, yeah, I just think that if you're looking at the Warriors, and maybe, like you said, all of this comes down to that inferiority complex, but from the outside, it's tough to make the case for sacking David Blatt and going to this high-tempo offense that they've been talking about.
All right, so I think you and I have agreed that next time Kate's in Russia, David Blatt is our first go-to guest host?
Maybe so, yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
He might be coaching in Russia then.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's what Kate's doing over there.
Yeah.
Seeing David Blatt at his new job. All right, let's leave it there and move on to tennis. Right before the start of the Australian Open, BuzzFeed News and the BBC published the results of a year-long investigation that suggested top tennis players were throwing matches. Using data on betting lines, they analyzed 26,000 professional matches and found 15 players whose matches seem to have suggested foul play or at least foul betting lines, and we'll get to perhaps the difference coming up. Here to talk about it is Hot Takedown's senior global special tennis correspondent, Carl Bialik. Hi, Carl.
Glad to be here.
Carl, what do you think of your new promotion?
I just want to meet the regional correspondent. We should collaborate.
You have to hire them. I forgot. That's part of your role as the senior global special tennis correspondent.
That's why Kate's in Russia, actually, scouting other international.
So she's scouting David Blatt's new job and international global.
She is the senior global tennis talent. Scout.
Yes, exactly. All right. So, Carl, the story came out in two different publications right before the Australian Open and really shook things up within the tennis world. Do you want to just give us a quick recap of what it said?
Sure. I'd say it was really a two-pronged investigation. One was the data side, which was, let's look at all these matches. Let's look at what the betting odds were right when the match was announced, and then what the betting odds were when the match started. And if you see the odds changing significantly, it suggests there was a lot of money on one side of the betting line. And then if the player whom the odds moved against actually lost, then that suggests maybe somebody had some reason to know that the bookies were wrong and that player was clearly not going to win, even though the bookies gave him or her a chance to win.
Are there betting lines even on tennis matches that most of us have never heard of? Like the lowest of the low, not lowest of the low, but just like obscure tennis matches and obscure tournaments?
No, I think lowest of the low is fair. There are betting lines pretty much all the way down in the professional ranks. And it's pretty well known that fixing matches is a problem pretty low down because prize money is almost negligible and definitely doesn't cover costs. What was different about this analysis is it was just looking at tour-level matches. So there's still definitely some obscure players to – maybe not me because I watch way too much tennis, but to most people who are just casual fans. But these are at least matches where they're the major leagues of tennis. So it might not be Wimbledon, but it would still be considered a tour-level match. And that's somewhat surprising because there the prize money is bigger. These are players who are more able to actually make a living at the sport. It's higher visibility, so bigger risk of getting caught and getting banned. So that was the second prong of the investigation, was the argument that authorities have known about this problem, have known about these kinds of analyses, but also other kinds of evidence, but haven't acted on it, so that they've repeatedly heard names of some of the players who are known to do this or suspected of doing this, including some who came up in this data analysis, and that they didn't act on it. They didn't investigate it, or they didn't investigate it thoroughly enough, and then didn't suspend the players or punish them in any meaningful way.
Got it. Okay, and so BuzzFeed chose not to name the players that, this analysis had pointed the way to, basically, but did release data publicly around it, as well as the algorithm they use, I think, to decipher the data. So I think it was you called in your piece the BuzzFeed 15. Is that right? So we have these 15 players. We're not going to out them here. There are
although they've been outed, right?
Right. Various corners of the internet. You can find these names if you need to find them. But, you know, so do we know – we don't know for sure if they threw the matches, or is the preponderance of evidence so large that it's almost certain that they did?
We're in a tricky middle ground, a kind of uncanny valley, or in tennis terms, no man's land. We think there's probably good reason to suspect some of them have. What we don't know is, first of all, that all of them have. We also don't know that all the matches that BuzzFeed flagged as being suspicious were thrown. So – for instance, if they found that 20 times the odds moved against you and 18 times you lost the match, maybe you would have lost 10 of those times anyway just because the other player was better. So that's one of the reasons I think they rightly chose not to name them, that without a lot of other evidence, you really don't know for sure. One name in particular on the list was a very familiar, famous one, and so people really dug into his matches and found a lot of other potential reasons why he might have lost matches where the odds moved against him other than the matches being fixed.
Yeah, what are some of the reasons other than fixing that could cause a big shift in the lines or the betting markets in the middle of a match like this?
Well, so to be clear, these are lines pre-match.
Oh, pre-match, okay.
They discussed in the piece this other problem, which is lines can move during the match, and if they move in the opposite direction of the way the match is going, like if I'm winning but I'm actually becoming a better bet even though I'm winning and you should get less of a payoff for me because it looks more likely like I'm going to win, that's a problem. That's suspicious. What's happening here is the match is announced, let's say, 2 days before that these two players are going to play and odds are set. And then just before the match starts, there are new odds. The odds have changed over that time. So that could be because the match is fixed and people know it and are betting on it.
And these odds are changing because people are constantly flooding money into the market.
Certainly that's one major reason why odds could change. It could also be that the bookmakers themselves got new information. But if the money's flooding in, it could be that people know before the bookmakers do that one of the players is injured. That could happen because the player told people in his camp who told other people who told other people. Could be that he's betting directly on it. Could be his family is. It could be I walked by his practice session and saw that he was looking kind of gimpy, and so I'm going to bet on the opponent. It could be that I put a really big bet and other people who are smart in the market notice that the line is moving and think something's up, and so they all pile on in the same way. So there are lots of things that could be happening besides I directly have agreed with a gambler to throw the match.
Yeah, after I read your two pieces you've written about this, Carl, I just thought to myself, like, it may be that that match is being thrown, or just maybe that that betting lines and gambling on tennis is a flawed system, and it's creating these anomalies. And if you look in a certain way and with a certain lens, then you're going to notice anomalies, and you're going to try and piece together a rationale for those anomalies. And you might end up maybe not overstepping things, but at least in an interpretation that is not fully founded.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting method for winnowing down among those 26,000 matches, which are the ones that are worth looking at more mm-hmm. closely, and then which among hundreds and thousands of players are worth looking at more closely, but not necessarily only finding players who throw
and
matches.
One of the tricks here is that the role of who should be looking at that more closely is presumably tennis associations, as opposed to this being adjudicated in the public, where this kind of complicated rush to judgment can happen.
Yeah, and I think it creates a really interesting tension because BuzzFeed argued, and I and other people have argued, that tennis is really not transparent about this. And it's really hard to know what they're doing. So if they say we are looking into it, we just have to kind of trust them. But on the other hand, if they did this totally out in the open and looked into leads and turns out the player wasn't fixing, that player's reputation could be ruined for no reason.
And as a result, what we've seen this week is, or this week or last week in the Australian Open, is that a mixed doubles match has come under this kind of scrutiny because of a shift in betting lines. I think during the match, Carl, it seems to me like this is sort of like a recency bias thing. Like, well, there's match fixing in tennis, so there must be one happening at the Australian Open.
Yeah, it's a really hard one to get your head around because there's certainly recency bias. There's also just, well, maybe this actually was going on all the time anyway, and now journalists are paying attention. So it's a good kind of recency bias that we're finally doing things other than just writing down what players said in press conferences. It's also just such a strange time to do it. I wrote a story about this yesterday. Why would you risk, for maybe tens of thousands of dollars, why would you risk being suspended from tennis for life right at a time when everyone is looking so closely?
And in some ways, doesn't this almost provide more evidence that the previous flagged matches might not have been fixed? Because if presumably under this microscope of this week, after this big BuzzFeed report, you're seeing the same type of action kind of move right before the match, and presumably no one would be dumb enough to fix something, like you said, during the week after the report, then it just underscores how this can happen naturally, and we just were not paying attention. You know, it's something that just kind of happens in the course of these markets. But since we have this recency bias, now we're kind of, you know, assuming and assigning some kind of negative motivation.
That's definitely a compelling possible explanation. I think it's also quite possible this match was fixed, so I don't want to go too far. I mean, that's, you know, suppose that there would have been 10 fixed matches at the Australian Open and 9 of them, oh, that's a really dumb thing, we're going to wait a couple of months to do this again.
But that one was dumb.
Exactly. and, you know, there's been other suspicions around one of the players in the match, and people who have watched the video don't all say, well, clearly he was fixing, but a lot of them say, well, he looked kind of weird on some of those points, some of the shots he chose. So, you know, he said after the match, really the problem is that when I play mixed doubles, I have trouble giving all of my power and skill because of women on the court or something like that.
Ah, sexism.
Gotta bring in sexism.
Exactly. So is the bigger sin sexism or fixing? Maybe he's a sexist and a fixer. But
well, he's definitely a sexist.
What a winner that guy is.
Or purporting to be to cover up his fixing.
To cover up his fixing.
But, you know, whatever it is, it's definitely evidence that we need more than just even the video and the betting movement. But tennis authorities can, you know, look at his bank records, look at his phone records, and if he's dumb enough to fix during the Australian Open, maybe he's dumb enough to use his phone to text with gamblers, hey, the fix is on.
So at 538, we're very interested in all things data, obviously, but also the power and the limitations of data to solve problems. And I'm wondering, Carl, you know, as you look back at the investigative report from BuzzFeed and the BBC and the fallout that has followed, are you optimistic about the power of data to sort of find wrongdoing in this way, has this only shown that it can only take you so far?
I think I'm cautiously optimistic. I think it was interesting that BuzzFeed cross-referenced its data-based results, these 15 names, with the names from these other reports, and said that almost half of them were showing up in other reports. So they were trying to corroborate it with other evidence, which is an important step to do when you do a data analysis. I also think people who have responded to their report, especially after the 15 names came out, have used data in really intelligent ways to dig into specific matches. So first you use the broad sweep of data, the 26,000 matches. Then with just 15 matches, you can dig into the very rich data on each one of those matches.
15 players, you mean?
The 15 players, sorry, in a few hundred matches. You can really dig into each of those players and each of those matches now that you're not dealing with such a prohibitively large data set.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, from the outside looking in, it seemed like one of these things that we'll look back on as a step towards something in regards to the way that we police behavior within sport. I'm not sure what that something is, whether it ends up being stronger in-house investigations within leagues and associations or this kind of outsourcing to the public. So we'll keep an eye on that. All right, Carl, we'll let you get back to your special global tennis correspondent duties. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, look forward to writing about things other than corruption in tennis.
Excellent. All right, now let's move on to Significant Digit when Allison McCann brings us a telling number from the world of sports. Allison, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Chad.
What do you have for us this week?
I have the number two, which is very telling. It is the number of female coaches that are now in the NFL. The Buffalo Bills hired Catherine Smith as the league's first full-time female coach last week. She will be an assistant special teams quality control coach, if anyone can tell me what that means. And this now puts the NFL at a tie with the NBA in terms of the sheer number of female coaches. However, I think it's worth adding a little bit of nuance to this data, since the average number of coaches in the NFL is vastly different than that in the NBA. So while I guess I'd like to champion the NFL for the hiring of this assistant special teams quality control, I guess I'm still not very impressed. You know, the average number of coaches on an NFL team is somewhere around 20-21. Mm. So this, you know, puts the percentage of female coaches in the NFL at like
2 out of 600 or something. Yeah,
0.2%. Whereas in the NBA, staff positions are obviously far more coveted, you know, 5 to 6 on a team. So that puts the percentage of female coaches somewhere closer to 1 or 2%. So I don't know. These are both pretty dismal, but it's just barely better than what we see in the NCAA, which I think is also interesting to note that if we expect more from our professional leagues, then we're probably going to need to also see an increase of.
And I think we just ran a piece of 538 that said that female coaches in women's college basketball were on the decline recently, that the inroads that had been made to get women coaching women within that sport has it stalled, basically.
Yeah, they're more underrepresented today than they were, I guess, a decade ago. We wrote about Pat Summitt, the right. famous Tennessee coach's 900th game, I think it was.
Win.
But yeah, and overall in Division I sports, 60% of women's coaches are men. Only about 3% of all men's coaches are women.
Yeah, it's an interesting one about so Allison, the numbers and the data that you pulled was from a piece from our colleague Leila Bresco on 538. It's interesting about whether or not, you know, if when we're doing the 10-year anniversary of Hot Takedown, I don't know if this sig dig is going to have changed much. You know,
yeah.
Like there are a lot of ways I feel like sports will be modernized and to keep up with the society around it, but I'm not sure that men's sports is going to budge on this in the end, and maybe that's the cynic in me.
Well, I don't know. 10 years ago, I don't think people were even talking about women coaches in the NFL as being like a legitimate possibility. And as for the you know, the quality control coach, like, people made fun of it. It sounds kind of weird as a position.
I just didn't know what it was, actually.
But it actually is kind of like a statistical analysis position in some ways, where like the coach sits down and charts plays by hand in a lot of cases off of film or off of, you know, advanced scouting other teams, and you know, tries to develop, you know, like hard evidence for certain tactical decisions that are made. So, you know, I don't know if that necessarily is a step up over any other job that would be like an entry-level position on an NFL coaching. But for what it's worth, a lot of people who went on to greater things as coaches started out as quality control coaches, and they swear by the experience in a lot of cases, where they say, like, this is what taught me, you know, how to become, you know, laid the groundwork to become an NFL coach. So maybe we'll see Catherine Smith, you know, on the sidelines in a head coaching role someday.
Hopefully.
All right. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Neil, we did okay.
Yeah, I think we held our own.
Yeah. We're excited to have a third member back next week for our Super Bowl preview show, along with some other topics, I'm sure.
And Russian topics,
yes,
I presume.
Yeah, maybe Kate will bring back some good, I don't know.
Anecdotes.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, cool Russian vocab about hot takes.
That
something.
Too, yeah.
Vodka?
Yeah, some good. Or vodka, yeah. That'll lead to us doing some hot takes. All right, so that's Neil Payne. That's Allison McCann. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast, I've said czar.
Czar
said emperor.
Would be fitting.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Oh, interesting. You want to go back to czar? All right, our podcast
but spell
czar,
it T-S-A-R.
Yes, czar is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Mantel. We get production assistance from Christine Laskowski and Tony Chow. Our intern is Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Guys, there's a new podcast in the 538 empire. by the way, an elections podcast. Sports people, you care about who wins, who loses, who's the best, who's the worst. This is just like Hot Takedown, but for politics and with fewer mentions of ELO ratings. You're going to love it. It's called 538 Elections. Look it up in the iTunes store. Subscribe to our podcast at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.